Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for this hour, and we hope you're staying safe and warm. We appreciate you tuning in to listen. We're going to start out the show today by focusing on politics, not presidential politics, but Iowa politics. We'll get a preview of some of what to watch for this year from the Iowa legislature. But before we get into that, last Saturday findings were finally released from the investigation into what happened to the Democratic Iowa caucuses. Remember those? I know it all seemed important back in February, but by now that all kind of feels like ancient history. However, it will become relevant again soon enough, right? Evan Berger is here to unpack the caucus story. Evan is a resident of Slater, and during the 2020 caucuses, he served as the caucus director for the Bernie campaign, and he served on the Iowa Democratic Party Caucus Review Committee in 2016. He published an op-ed piece about the caucuses last Tuesday in the Des Moines Register. Welcome, Evan. Thank you for coming to Local Talk.
Thanks so much for having me.
What did the report, what did the findings find? As we all remember, caucus night was a big shock for everybody because Iowa was not able to report the results. And as the hours ticked on, it became more and more obvious that the results were not going to come in for days, if ever really in any conclusive way. And huge questions were raised right away as to what happened. What happened in Iowa? Why weren't the caucuses able to deliver a result after months and months and months of intense worldwide scrutiny on the caucus process in Iowa, as well as an enormous investment on the part of Iowans all over the state in the process, in really practice of democracy in the most intense and local way possible. And I have to say, as having reported on it in the most sincere and serious way possible. And then all of a sudden, it seemed that somehow the system had gone wrong. So there was an inquiry called, and then, you know, events overtook us. And the Iowa caucuses, that report seemed to be kind of in the past, but now it has come out. And tell us what it says.
Yeah, definitely. So it recaps, the report recaps a lot of things that we already knew, but it, like you said, it seems like a long time ago. So it's good that it kind of goes over all that lead up to the caucuses. So for instance, the whole back and forth around virtual caucuses versus satellite caucuses, it recaps that information in detail.
When you say the back and forth, what do you mean?
The DNC, the Democratic National Committee, at the very beginning of the process for planning for the 2020 caucuses, says there, told Iowa there has to be some sort of way to participate in the caucuses if you're not able to attend in person on caucus night. And the Iowa Democratic Party, which I'll refer to as the IDP, the first way they tried to implement this, or the first plan they offered to implement that requirement, was the virtual caucuses, which would have been caucuses held over the phone. The DNC, the National Party, after going back and forth, eventually said that's not allowed. And the state party came back with a different proposal, which ultimately ended up being what they did, which was satellite caucuses, which were still in-person caucuses, but they were held at different places and different times than the standard precinct caucuses. So the report, again, goes over all of the lead up to the caucuses and all this, you know, information that was already public. But it also does have a lot of new information, mostly about two specific parts of the caucus process. The first one was the development of the phone app that precinct chairs, these are the people who run the caucus, were supposed to use to report the results of their caucus.
Yeah, the infamous phone app, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And so we learn a lot more about the infamous phone app and the development of it. You know, the short version is that it was way too complicated and chairs were not trained on it properly, which we knew already. But what the report tells us is one reason for that is that the DNC, again, the story is that the DNC inserted themselves into this process that the IDP was running. And said, whoa, 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 we got to make sure this thing is secure. We have all these concerns. We want to be involved in the development of this app. And according to the report, at least, that was one of the main reasons for the delay in the development of the app, which then led to a delay in training people on the app, which then led to the situation that we had where fewer than 30% of precinct chairs ended up using the app to report their results. The rest reported them by phone, which overwhelmed the backup system as well as the primary system for reporting results. And therefore, they went to the backup, which ended up just being chairs calling in results. And then the IDP wrote the results down on sheets of paper and then had to shuffle through those papers to add everything up at the end.
Yeah, so, it was interesting on caucus night. I would say almost from 10 different parts of the state, people sent their results into us because they weren't able to get them into the DNC or the Iowa Democratic Party, and they were texting us the results. And we were trying to figure out why are people sending us their results, you know? But you know, later on we understood that it was happening simply because we were the only people they could get through to, which was like, as they say, it was really random, you know, like getting random results from different counties throughout the state. You know, there's not much we could do with that information in right. out of context like that.
Yeah, yeah. And but, people were, if you think back to caucus night, people were really just struggling. You know, individual precinct chairs were really struggling to figure out, you know, this is a big job. They understand how big of a job it is to run an Iowa caucus. And when, you know, the phone system isn't working and the app isn't working and you have this information, which seems really important, which is here are the results of my caucus. I think people were really, really struggling. So,
but does the report say anything new? Because I think, you know, what you're telling us is kind of what everybody figured out. I mean, everybody figured out it was the app didn't work that well. And mostly people didn't seem to know how to use it and hadn't been trained, which was hard for lay people. I mean, it's hard. It was hard to understand why they wouldn't train people enough to do this. Does the report say anything new? Does it give any explanation about why this was even allowed to happen? I mean, they had years to prepare.
Exactly. Well, I think that's what it comes down to is they had years to prepare, but the state party started preparing this app. And then I believe it was over the summer of prior to the caucuses, the DNC came in and said, wait, we want to be involved in this. We don't think you're doing a good job of developing this app. And therefore, we're going to insert ourselves into this process, raise a bunch of security concerns, work with the vendor directly. They didn't start developing the final version of the app until September. And that's why the final version of the app wasn't put into caucus chair's hands until weeks before the caucuses. And that's the story that the report tells. This is new information. We could have guessed it, you know, that there was probably fighting behind the scenes between the different levels of the Democratic Party. But that's one piece of new information is the role of the DNC in that whole kind of chaos around the app.
I don't know. This is probably a question that report didn't answer. But, you know, a lot of questions were raised about the people that were involved, that it turned out the company that was involved with developing the app was aligned with certain of the candidates or had been, you know, more involved with some of the candidates like Buttigieg and Biden than other candidates. Is anything said about that? I mean, they were kind of implications that there was, you know, certain factions of the Democratic Party was over-involved with the development of the app?
The report doesn't really speak to that. And I think my understanding is that it is true that the Biden and Buttigieg campaigns had contracted Shadow, which is the name of the old name of this company, now goes by Blue Link.
Gave up that brand, right?
Exactly. They had to rebrand. But yeah, they'd contracted with this company before for other projects. According to the report, the report doesn't really address it. I haven't seen any evidence that bled over into the caucus app, but you could always ask, you know, people certainly are asking questions about, well, if this company has other, has clients who are affected by the, you know, this other project, could that have spilled over? I mean, I think my big takeaway from the report is that the caucus process was just as chaotic on the inside as it looked from the outside. And there were just as many failures as it looked like there were. And so when I read the report, I don't see a story of like premeditated intervention or anything like that. And honestly, you know, like with the IDP, I think the leadership of the state party this time around was very careful to be very fair. And, you know, I felt a lot more involved as a Bernie staffer this time around than I did in 2016. So I don't think that personally, I don't know that we'll ever know, but I don't think that was the case.
So it sounds like the report really lays the blame more on the National Democratic Party for having unrealistic demands on the Iowa Democratic Party. Is that what's being said?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the other big piece of new information, too, is similarly. So the big And the thing everyone remembers about the caucus is, of course, that there were no results at all released on caucus night. Not even, you know, one precinct. They didn't even release one precinct's results until the following day, which was the cause for all this consternation among the press and among the campaigns. There wasn't any data at all to work off of.
We did a national report coverage here out of KHOI, and that was one tough night to report on.
Yeah. Well, and you can imagine how it was in campaign headquarters, you know, people breathing down.
Yeah, I cannot imagine. I don't know if I would want to imagine that. Yeah. It must have been, you know, one heck of a night for those people. I guess, you know, the other thing that I've heard floating around sometimes, and I'm wondering if the report in any way addressed this, that there was almost a sense that the National Democratic Party had stopped taking the caucuses seriously enough to really give it the kind of support or, you know, cooperation that it needed to succeed with the caucuses. Any hint of that?
Well, there's definitely hints of that. That's in the report and in the, you know, all the reporting around this whole process. So, yeah, what the report says about the caucus night release of results is, again, it places the bulk of the blame for that decision at the feet of the DNC with some help from technology. So what the report says happened on caucus night is the state party had developed this entire, you know, reporting software to track the results of all the precincts as they came in and add them up and you know, come up with a statewide SDEs and, you know, the results that we all were expecting to see. And then at the very last minute, literally the week before the caucuses, the DNC came in and said, we actually want you to translate those results into our database as well, because essentially we don't trust you to run the process. And that's this, you know, that's kind of the same story that we see in the report around the development of the app. The National Party comes in and says, okay, State Party, we know you're doing this thing, but we don't trust you to do it well enough. So we want to be involved too. And that intervention did, in this case, directly lead to a failure, which was that they could not write the code to do that translation between databases in time. And that code produced wonky results on caucus night. The DNC's translation tool introduced errors into the results. So the results that the DNC was looking at had apparent errors in them. The DNC freaked out and said, this is terrible. This, you know, there are all these errors. There's these problems. You cannot release these results tonight to the state party. And that's, again, the new information. This is official, you know, that's the first official confirmation that we'd had that the of that kind of decision-making process that led up to not releasing any results. And in this case, it definitely seems like the DNC caused the problem by insisting on this data translation issue or data translation tool, and also by making the decision to stop all results when they saw those errors, which, again, were not in the actual results. The errors that they're talking about here were not in the IDP's tool. They were just in the translation.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, this is a big headline that all the reporting picked up on, is that the DNC was at fault for these big problems we saw in the caucuses. But we should also say that the DNC chose not to participate in this report. The writers of the report interviewed everyone at the IDP. They interviewed people from different campaigns from, you know, all up and down the volunteer structure here in Iowa. They reached out to the DNC and tried to schedule time with DNC representatives, and the DNC said no. It could be the case. I mean, first off, that looks badly. To answer your question, it doesn't seem like their DNC is particularly interested in anything to do with Iowa. But it could be the case that there is another side to the story, or there might be additional information about why DNC representatives decided to block results. But that's just another thing to keep in
mind. Yeah. Could the Iowa Democratic Party have just said no to all of this?
That's a great question. I mean, I understand that. So here's the dynamic, and your listeners have probably seen this play out in many different ways. So the dynamic is that the Iowa Democratic Party is obviously very interested in keeping first in the nation status. And in order to do that, we need to remain on good terms with the National Party.
Right.
Because
got it.
The National
okay.
Party ultimately is that the
kind
one
of,
that.
That kind of says it all right there.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Well, thank you, Evan. Real quick before you go, we have to wrap it up, but you did write an op-ed piece. What was the gist of your recommendations?
My piece, which people can read the details, obviously, but the short version is that One of the recommendations in the report is that the caucus process itself is far too complicated. And, you know, a system of this complexity, it's kind of unsurprising that there were failures at different points. And therefore, the report says that the Democratic Party should reconsider whether we hold caucuses at all, which I think is a pretty radical position and not one that, yeah, I mean, we should definitely reconsider it. But the I hope we keep them around. I think there's a lot to like about the caucuses. But if we do keep them around, they do need to be much simpler. And there's an obvious way that the report points out that we can make them a lot simpler, which is getting rid of all the delegate math that takes place on caucus night, instead just using the popular vote to determine the winner of the Iowa caucuses. So the big thing that I harp on is we got to get rid of these state delegate equivalents. That's this kind of accounting mechanism that the IDP uses or has used to calculate the winner of caucus night. And it's just, it's so complicated. No one understands it. It requires all this math to be done in the room on by the each caucus chair. And it also leads to, you know, this enormously complicated computer system. You have to have a computer system that's equally complicated to the rules. You know, when I read the report, that's what I kept seeing over and over again. It's like they had to develop this software that was so massive and bloated because the rules themselves are so difficult. So that's my recommendation, is we got to simplify the caucuses. I agree completely with the report that the Republican Party has a much simpler model, and one that we could easily adopt, or, you know, adopt with a minimum of difficulty. And I think that's exactly what we should do.
Thank you. We actually recorded one of the officials explaining the math, and we put it to music, and it worked really great as poetry. It was really interesting that way. But anyway, we've been speaking with Evan Berger, who is a resident of Slater and also was the caucus director for the Bernie campaign in 2020 and served on former committees reviewing the caucuses. Thank you, Evan, for joining us. And your op-ed piece was in the Des Moines Register on Tuesday, right?
That's right. Exactly right.
Okay. Thank you, Evan. Appreciate it.
Bye.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for the hour. Going to stick with politics a little bit longer. This should be an eventful year at the Iowa legislature level with the change in the balance of power in the Iowa legislature being fully now in the Republican court. KHOI, in order to bring you reports on what's going to happen this year, KHOI has been able to begin making arrangements with political observer Laura Bellin to cover this coming year. And we hope that Laura is going to be able to bring us reports on a regular basis to keep us posted once things start to happen in Des Moines. Ms. Bellin is the author of Bleeding Heartland, a community blog about Iowa politics, especially campaigns, elections, state government, social and environmental issues. I'm telling you a little bit about her because we're kind of excited about having her on the team. Laura loves politics, and she says she grew to love them growing up, discussing it at the dinner table. She found her love of politics as an analyst for the Prague-based Open Media Research Institute, and later for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and she covered Russian campaigns and elections, parliamentary politics and media issues, and covered Russia, I think, spanning from 1999 to 2005. And the Des Moines City View's Civic Skinny called Bellin probably the hardest working and probably the best political reporter in the state and one of the best investigative reporters in the state. So Laura comes with incredibly great credentials, and she's also been great to work with. So we're very pleased to have Laura on the KHOI team to bring you news and information. Welcome, Laura, and thank you for being willing to come on and give us just a taste of what's coming this year in Des Moines, just to give us a sense of what we can expect and what we should be watching for when the legislature begins to convene again.
Well, thanks so much, Ursula. It's really good to be here. And I just wanted to first give your listeners some context. So the legislature has been fully Republican controlled for the last 4 years, but the majorities are very large now by historical standards. So the Republicans in the Iowa Senate have a 32-18 majority, and in the House they have a 59-41 majority. So that means they really have a lot of room to pass almost any legislation that the caucuses want. For the past year, the House Republicans had only 53 of the 100 seats. So that was a little bit difficult. There were some bills they had trouble getting the 51 votes for, because if it only takes three or four people in your caucus to cause a problem, then, but I would say that generally speaking, the big picture right now is that Republican leadership in the Iowa House and Senate have really a free hand to do almost anything that they want. The one area where I would say Democrats still have a little bit of leverage is that in the Iowa Senate, it requires a 2/3 vote to confirm the governor's nominees. And that includes all kinds of state boards and commissions in addition to cabinet directors. Right now, that means that the Reynolds administration would need 34 votes out of 50. And usually votes to confirm the governor's nominees are usually unanimous or almost unanimous. But a few times a year, if the Democratic caucus really objects to somebody, they can, if they stand firm, all 18 of them, they could block that person from getting enough votes to be confirmed. And we're probably going to see confirmation votes coming up this session on the leader of the Department of Administrative Services. That is the agency that handles human resources for state government. We're going to see certainly a vote to confirm the director of the Department of Education, who's someone the governor had just nominated last March. And as well, we just learned very recently that the director of the Department of Homeland Security is retiring in January. So the governor may nominate someone during this legislative session. So those are potentially some votes. And I don't really anticipate any particular problems, although it's always possible that usually at one or two people run into problems with confirmation in the Iowa Senate. But as for issues that they'll consider, I think the COVID-19 pandemic, of course, is going to be the biggest issue, both from a budget perspective and just from public policy. So it may be that the legislature needs to pass some kind of supplemental appropriation, either to fill shortfalls or to cover additional needs that couldn't be covered through the federal COVID relief. I think we'll know a little bit more in a few weeks when we find out whether Congress passes another relief package that includes some aid to state governments. But if they don't, it's possible, even with the state's fiscal condition looking pretty good right now, it's possible that the legislature would have to do some kind of supplemental appropriation. And another issue related to the pandemic that I think we're going to need to watch is related to the governor's emergency powers. The Iowa law right now gives the governor pretty broad emergency powers to declare a public health emergency and to keep extending it and to regulate public life in a range of areas. And there are some states where the legislature has more of a role in that process. So, for instance, in Minnesota, the governor's emergency powers are more time limited. So their legislature has been regularly coming back this year to vote on whether to extend the governor's emergency powers. And the Iowa House Judiciary Committee Chairman Stephen Holt has said publicly that he intends to start a debate, and he has some allies. We don't know how many. They haven't identified themselves, but he would like to pass some laws to limit the governor's executive authority to regulate the size of gatherings and business activities. And so we'll see whether that gets much traction in the legislature. I don't really expect that the majority of the House and Senate Republicans will want to take the governor on this, but I'm very curious to see how widespread that sentiment is within the majority.
Other areas that you think that might be addressed?
Tax policy is a big one. Last year, of course, before anyone knew there would be a pandemic, one of the governor's signature bills was the Invest in Iowa Act. And that was something where she would have raised the state sales tax by a penny, and 38% of it would have gone toward the state natural resources trust fund. This is something that the voters approved in 2010, but it's never been funded. When it was approved, with the understanding that the next time Iowa raised the sales tax, 3/8 of a penny would go into that fund. So the 3/8, if that happened, the 3/8 would go into the fund. The 5/8 would be additional revenue. And then the governor had all kinds of ideas about groups and individuals who would get tax cuts to offset that revenue. But there was a lot of opposition to that. It was not clear last year, even before they suspended everything with the pandemic. It was not clear whether that had enough support in the Republican caucus. And I just saw a few days ago that Dan Dawson, he's a senator from Council Bluffs, and he is the new chair of the Ways and Means Committee. That's the tax writing committee in the Senate. And he's very wary about this because he lives in a border community and he feels that raising the sales tax would make Iowa businesses less attractive to people in the Omaha metropolitan area. So he's just one, but Brad Zahn, a senator from Urbandale, is another person who had raised a lot of concerns about the sales tax. So we'll see. The Democrats in general in the legislature, you know, many have supported funding the trust fund, but many are also wary about raising the sales tax because it's regressive. And so from the Democratic perspective, they would rather see, if the sales tax is raised, they would rather see it offset with more relief, like an increase in the earned income tax credit or other benefits that would go to the working poor. And that may not be on the table.
Right.
So that's an issue where we'll have to see what they come up with. The Senate Republicans have, at the last couple of years, they've also tried to pass bills that would increase the work requirements for receiving public assistance. So that would be both the food aid that people sometimes still call food stamps, but it's called SNAP benefits right now, or even qualifying for Medicaid. And the Democrats have fought that. And what happened last year is the Iowa House Human Resources Chairman basically put those bills in a drawer and never gave them a committee hearing. Her name was Shannon Lundgren, but she has actually moved with a new committee assignment. She is now chairing the House Commerce Committee, and there's a new chair, Ann Meyer from Fort Dodge. She's chairing the Human Resources Committee. So I anticipate the Iowa Senate is going to pass more bills along those lines, and then we'll see if this time it gets a more sympathetic hearing in the Iowa House, because that's the kind of bill where if it comes to the floor, if leadership decides they want to bring that bill to the floor, probably it would have enough votes to pass. But it's sometimes bills just get killed, and actually many times bills never make it out of committee. So most of the bills that people introduce never make it onto the floor for a vote in the full chamber. So that's something also that I think is worth watching.
Sounds like a lot of stress around finance and money.
Yes. Well, actually, the Legislative Services Agency, which is a nonprofit, the legislative staff, they do a fiscal analysis on these bills. And they have determined in the past it would actually be more expensive to implement some of these work requirements because of the new administrators. You'd have to hire a lot more administrators to just keep track of eligibility of the program, especially with Medicaid. And so they actually wouldn't even pay for themselves, at least according to the fiscal notes attached to the previous year bills. And I think that's one reason why they never got a hearing in the House. But we'll see whether it's possible they could tweak the legislation, or it's possible that they might decide that with a budget surplus that doesn't matter. There was one more area that I wanted to mention, if we have time, and that's redistricting. So we're in the year ending in zero, which means there was a census. And in the year ending in one, the legislature always approves a new map of political boundaries for both the congressional districts and the state legislative districts. And that is going to happen sometime next year. The timetable might be a little bit different from usual, because normally the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency, again, normally they get the first series of maps to the legislators by April 1st. But the U.S. Census Bureau is a little bit delayed because of some issues related to the pandemic. They are delayed in transmitting their information to the states on just all of the different data that they've collected this year. So normally that would be transmitted by December 31st. Or it would be sent to Congress at least by December 31st. And so it's possible that if all of that data doesn't even get to Iowa until February or March, that the maps could be coming out later. They might come out as late as May. So it's possible that the legislature, if they've already adjourned for the year in late April, as sometimes happens, they may have to come back for a special session to consider the redistricting map. But that's something where there's a little bit of anxiety in Democratic circles over whether Republicans are going to stick with the nonpartisan redistricting process we have now. So far, the Republican leaders have said they don't plan to change that process. It is possible that they could vote down the nonpartisan maps and then amend a third proposal to what could be a gerrymander, but they so far they haven't indicated that they plan to do that. But it's something that will need to be watched next year.
Okay, thank you. Well, that's a lot to think about, just for starters. And I'm sure there's lots more to come, right?
Yes, yes, lots more areas that we can, and other later times we can talk about energy or reproductive rights or some other areas.
Absolutely,
that the
in the environment too, right? I saw yes, there's definitely. There's already something issues going on about fulfilling environmental requirements. So yes, there'll be lots to talk about. Well, we'll save that for later, and we'll look forward to working with you on this, Laura. Thank you so much for being part of the KHOI team. Yeah,
thank you.
It's gonna be an interesting year, so it's good to have you here. Thank you so much.
Yes.
And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for the hour. Thank you for being with us on this cold winter day. It is winter now, definitely. Susan Guiazda is here again with us. Welcome back, Susan Guiazda, Public Relations Officer for the City of Ames. And with her is Rich Higgins, Ames Fire Chief and City of Ames COVID Coordinator. Thank you guys for coming back and giving us an update on what's happening.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thank you, Ursula, for having us. Just a couple of reminders before we get started. I know it seems early and we're still in December, but planning is moving forward for a Martin Luther King Jr. celebration. Typically, our community would celebrate that at the Ames Middle School, but this year we're going to do a virtual event, and the city is one of the partners in holding this event, and I just wanted to kind of get a save the date out there. It will be a virtual meeting on Monday, January 18th, a virtual celebration. We still haven't figured out how to do the cake, but the rest of the recognition will go on, and there's lots of activities planned leading up into the celebration. So stay tuned for those. I'm just getting that early reminder out there. One of the reasons I asked Chief Higgins to join us today is because he is coordinating our city efforts with the fight against COVID. And while we've achieved some significant milestones recently with a vaccine coming and on the way, there are other things that we cannot let off on, and that is our healthy behaviors. Rich is the one who's been keeping track of the numbers and coordinating with all our local community partners. So I just wanted him to provide an update.
Welcome, Rich. Thank you for coming back. So how does it look right now?
Right now, I don't want to say we've hit a plateau, but things have kind of leveled off just a little bit. We've been holding steady, if not dropping just a little bit day by day. The state is sitting at a 13.9% positivity rate as of yesterday morning, and Story County is down to a 9.3%. So we're kind of hovering. Story County's been hovering around that 9 to 11 range over the last few weeks, and the state has definitely seen a decrease. You know, a month ago, the state was sitting at a little over 22%, and to be down to under 14% is really remarkable. What that tells me is that, so this was through the Thanksgiving period and where we expected to see a surge, and we did see a little bit of a bump up. But what that tells me is that our community is doing their part, and that's really encouraging to know that people are staying home when they're sick, they're washing their hands, they're physically distancing, and they're wearing their masks. And so those are really great indicators of what's happening in our community, that, that people are doing their part, and what the governor did with some of the actions that she's taken to limit those exposure possibilities actually helped and worked. They were good mitigation efforts.
What was, again, the percentage in Story County? You said 9%. Is that right?
Story County right now is down to
10.3. What does that mean in actual relationship with hospital beds?
I couldn't speak to that right now. Just I'm not for sure where Mary Greeley's at. That's really probably their story to tell. I think they're doing okay. We'll find out today. Thursday is when we meet with our community partners, so we'll get an update from Amber Deerdorf as well as Chris Perrin over at Mary Greeley to let us know how they're doing. I haven't had any alerts from them when they were, there was a point in time, you know, kind of around that November 18th through the end of the month where things were busy over at the hospital for sure.
Are you ever aware that did it ever come to a time where Mary Greeley said we can't handle the numbers?
I don't think so. Mary Greeley has just been impressive throughout this entire process of through their staff and relocating patients throughout the hospital. They've done just an amazing job. In fact, they've really been a hub for other hospitals to bring patients into Mary Greeley. I know they've had patients from Boone, Marshall County, Hardin County. They've really been a hub for other hospitals to bring their patients in. So those other hospitals could focus on other things. Mary Greeley could help support with COVID, just with their staff and some of the treatments that they have there. So kudos to Mary Greeley. They've been great in this process. I think one of the other things that we need to point out is with the vaccination efforts going on right now, I don't believe Story County, in my conversations yesterday with public health, has received the COVID vaccine yet. I think that's supposed to happen either today or tomorrow, but they are supposed to be receiving a shipment in. And we just got to give kudos to Les, Teresa, and Sherry over at public health, Story County Public Health. They've done an amazing job, and their job is only going to get harder as they start to work on vaccination process and getting everybody vaccinated.
So when you say they're doing an amazing job, what do they have to do?
You know, throughout this process, they've done all the contact tracing. They've been following Iowa Department of Public Health, meeting with them to find out what's changing as far as some of those mitigation efforts. We saw a change between quarantine time. We went from being in a 14-day quarantine to now a period of 7 days if you can get a test at day five of being having an exposure, or 10 days if you don't get a test. So there's been a lot of changes. And just in what I learned a little bit yesterday in talking with Les, the process for vaccination is just incredible. So they have cold storage over there for the Pfizer vaccine. They can only open up that freezer twice a day. And when they do, and they take out the supplies they need for that period of time to give vaccines, they have a 6-hour window. And within that time frame, there's 2 hours that it takes to thaw out the vaccine. And then there's a process that they need to regenerate it. They have to reconstitute the vaccine, and then they have to get it ready to distribute and give out. So they're working in some tight parameters, and so they're working through all the logistics that are behind getting a vaccine. I think we probably take it for granted getting a flu shot vaccine, but there's a lot of work that goes into actually rolling up your sleeve and getting that shot on the back end that the, you know, Les and her team do all the time.
It seems like it requires refrigerator trucks too, right? You have to move it.
Absolutely. Yep. And so there's dry ice that they're using in the storage containers during transportation. And then once it's on site, they have sub-zero freezers that they're keeping the vaccine in. Mm-hmm. On the fire department side, with any time you're using dry ice, there's always a concern of carbon dioxide, which is what dry ice is basically. And so it produces, as it starts to melt down, it produces carbon dioxide, which will displace oxygen. And so that's something we've been reminding all of our fire crews on the hazmat side. Make sure we have our air monitors ready to go in case there would be an accident, either through transportation or through one of these cold storage facilities that would require us to respond if there is a dry ice emergency.
All right. I just wanted to remind you again that remember that both the vaccines have a 2-shot regimen, which means that not only are you tracking the patients for the first round, but then you've got a 21 or 28 day second shot. And so there's a lot of back end work that goes into not only just prepping the vaccines, but tracking when people need to get the second round. it's extremely complex. And then you have all the special transportation needs and the storage needs. And so this is going to be a process. It's going to be huge.
So really none of this has happened yet. It's all just in the planning stages, right? Because that they don't actually, they haven't started doing it.
Correct. I think today or tomorrow will be the day that they're supposed to be getting the shipment in. Right. They've been getting everything else in place. And, you know, the hospital has done a great job too. Dr. Fulton and McFarland Clinic. Dr. Fulton has a great video out on their Facebook page, Mary Greeley's Facebook page right now, that talks about the vaccine and really provides a background education for people on how the vaccine was developed. It gives you information on why you should get it or why you shouldn't. And so we really encourage people to go out there. It's been hard with social media. There's a lot of information out there that will people can find it anywhere they want, which is great. The internet has been a blessing to all of us in many ways, but it also has allowed some of us to become our own subject matter experts. And just as you would take a car that's not working to a mechanic, or you would go to a hairstylist to get your hair done, we encourage people when they start thinking about the vaccine, whether it's right for them, to get with their healthcare provider. They're the experts in that area. Talk with them, talk with your pharmacist. I'm blessed. My sister-in-law is in pharmacy. She's a pharmacist. I was able to talk to her last week about the vaccine and get a lot of great information that was able to really help encourage me to go out and want to get the vaccine based off the information she was able to provide me. So do your research, but make sure you're going to the right people to do it. Don't count on some of those social media platforms to be your subject matter experts. Actually go to your doctor, your pharmacist, and get the recommendation or information from them on the vaccine.
So when would this even be an option? Do you have a sense here in Story County?
Yeah, so the CDC and Iowa Department of Public Health have come out with guidance on who will get it and roughly when. And so there's three different categories. There's 1A, and that's going to be all of our frontline healthcare workers, all of our long-term care facility residents and workers.
Right, that's what we're doing now, right?
Yep, and emergency medical services. The 1B group is that essential service, the core essential services that keep everything up and running, that core infrastructure. So we're talking utilities, electric.
Is that
water.
When you're going to get yours?
So right now, Ames Fire is since we provide EMS in Story
County.
So you're
medical. Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah, so we fall in the 1A category right now, but that can change. What I've learned is things are changing rapidly. And we just want to support what public health is doing. And we,
having spoken to your sister, you're comfortable with getting the flu shot, the virus shot?
I am personally, yeah. And here's a little bit why. She just explained to me about the process and how it works. And everyone, and I have to caution, I'm not the expert. I am, when we're talking firefighting, I'm the expert in that area. But when we're talking about vaccines and public health, that's, I'm not the expert. So this is my personal experience. I just want to throw out that disclaimer. But when I was talking with my sister-in-law, what she reminded me is that even though this vaccine seemed rushed, the scrutiny that's gone under or has gone through is the normal scrutiny that any vaccine would. We're just missing that 5 years of long-term trial to figure out. And Dr. Fulton really talks a lot about, you know, how the coronavirus, we've had the coronavirus for a long time. We've know a lot about it. So developing a vaccine wasn't too far of a stretch with some of the Ebola and some of the other things that they'd been working on previously.
And HIV, HIV research.
So I think a big thing for me that helped for my sister-in-law was just the reminder that there's a lot of over-the-counter items that we take. There's supplements, there's vitamins that most of us take on a daily basis to some degree that have absolutely no FDA approval on them. But we don't hesitate to take them, even if it's an over-the-counter cough suppressant or medication if we're battling a cold or have aches and pains after going for a run that don't have FDA approval. This drug does. And so that's what was encouraging for me is that I need to trust the experts when it comes to vaccines. And that's what I'm doing is I'm putting my trust in science and in the experts for my personal decision. And I want to remind her, it is your personal decision. That's the nice thing. I don't know of anybody that's mandating the vaccine. I know we're not here in the city or in the fire department.
In terms of the priorities about who, you know, who are in these different phases, is this something that's decided on a state to state basis? Is that correct?
Yeah, so the CDC came out with federal guidance, and then each state has taken a look at that guidance and said, hey, this is how it's going to work within the state of Iowa or Idaho or Ohio. And in fact, yesterday I was kind of looking at that. It's different all over the place.
And who exactly in Iowa is the decider, so to speak?
So right now that would be the Iowa Department of Public Health. They've come out with the actual order that allows the vaccine to be given. And I believe the governor said a couple of weeks ago during a press conference that she is creating a board that would help look when we get into the 1B and the 1C categories for who should get the vaccine, that there'll be a board that helps make that decision of different people from different backgrounds.
Okay. Thank you. We're speaking with Rich Higgins, who is the Ames Fire Chief and also the coordinator for COVID in Ames. Rich, thank you for giving the update. Any other important information do you think we should know before we end?
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't talk a little bit about fire safety while I was on and had listeners okay. on. This is a great reminder with all the cooking that goes on during the holiday season, all those goodies out there is one easy reminder is when you're cooking in the kitchen and you don't want to leave things unattended, go ahead and take that spatula, keep it in your hand. When you walk back to your bedroom or you grab a phone call or somebody comes to your door to drop off those packages, if you keep that spoon or spatula in your hand, that's a good reminder that you have stuff back in the kitchen that needs to take you back there.
That's a great
tip. We're also encouraging
tip.
People right now with carbon monoxide, make sure your carbon monoxide detectors are working. Same way with smoke detectors. And be careful with candles. A lot of candles are getting lit this time of year. We just encourage people to be safe, know where they're at, especially with pets or small children. That's not a good idea to use lit candles. There's fake candles and also candle warmers out there. So be safe during the holiday season and enjoy it.
Rich, you wouldn't like my family. My family are European, and we put candles on the Christmas tree.
Oh, you're making me nervous, Ursula. I'll get your address off the air so we can have a crew ready just in case. No, I'm sure you guys are safe out there.
But if it makes you feel any better, I don't think we're going to have a Christmas tree this year. We've got too many other problems going on in the family. But anyway, thank you so much for coming on, Rich Higgins. And just one more quick question, and you probably can't answer this, but you had mentioned how Mary Greeley was kind of providing COVID services for the surrounding areas so that hospitals could do other things. Is there any chance that it'll serve that function with the vaccine because they have the facilities to do the storage that will become like a magnet?
I don't think so because uh-huh. every public health in every county within Iowa is really facilitating the vaccination process.
Individually.
That really becomes, public health. They're the ones that are working on all the logistics and scheduling. So I don't think that really involved the hospital a whole lot of at
okay.
all.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate you coming on and giving us updates. And I'm happy to hear that, things are going down. The perception really has been that it just keeps going up and up and up and everybody's feeling like, holy crap, where does this end? So it's great news to hear that actually we are – it is going down a little bit in our area, at least. That makes us lucky.
Yeah, it's encouraging. It tells me that people are doing their part, as hard as it is to stay home and socially distance and some of those things, especially during the holiday season.
Thank you, everybody, for doing your part, right? Appreciate
That's
it.
That's right. People are sacrificing for the greater good, and I'm excited to know that our community is making some good choices out there. So be
okay.
safe.
Thank you. And Susan, any last words?
No, I think Rich covered it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much, guys. Really appreciate you coming. Come back again. Thank you. Okay. We are coming around the last few minutes of the show, but I am excited to have Stephanie Bates here with us. She's been standing in the wings patiently. And Stephanie is a producer here at KHOI. She's the producer and host of Love of Music, which is on Thursday nights. It'll be on tonight at 10 o'clock. And she is on because today is December 17th, which, aside from being my little sister's birthday, it's also the last day of KHOI's holiday gift fair auction. And the auction closes tonight at 10 p.m. on the dot. So please go to the auction today and make your bids. I know everybody's been waiting, and so now we are watching the auction with bated breath as we head around in the last few hours. And the way you go to the auction site is go to khoifm.org and click on the big blue square that says KHOI Holiday Gift Fair Auction. And I've heard that the online orders have gone up 60% during the holiday because so many people are ordering online instead of shopping locally or in stores. So if you are one of those people that wants to shop online, if you order your gift through this auction, you will not experience a delay in getting your gift. We have it ready here. They're all sitting here at the station, and we will pass it to you safely or even deliver it to you safely. So this is a great place to get really, really unique gifts that have all been donated or created by members of our community. And Stephanie is one of those. Welcome to Local Talk, Stephanie. And Stephanie, she has not only volunteered her time to help build the auction, which was a lot of work, but she is also a jewelry vendor who has contributed quite a few pieces to the auction. So, Stephanie, tell us about a few of the pieces that you put in the auction.
Well, the one that I like is the purple glass pendant. And that one took me a considerable amount of time and effort as I'm learning as I go. So I'm learning how to make resin-based jewelry, and this is a different type of piece. It's stones, and there's a bracelet that I really like. I made those, so there's two items that I really want. I'm actually looking at them right now. there's a teddy bear, and I don't know, is his name, he made it. It says, so it's this beautiful teddy bear that I want. Here's the item description. Moritz is a registered designer teddy bear created in 1983 with a signed pedigree from the late teddy bear master, Steve Shutt. Mm-hmm. He was a native of Clarion, and he had an antique store. And then he became world-renowned for his high-end designer teddy bears. They sold in New York and many other major markets. He won multiple awards, traveled all over the world giving presentations, and was instrumental in founding the Teddy Bear Reunion in the Heartland. Steve died in 2017. Teddy Bear Moritz, this teddy bear, was named after a character in German author and artist Wilhelm Busch's 1865 story, Max and Moritz. Steve was introduced to the story when Ames puppeteers Veronica Rudenberg and Nancy Kegley made a show based on the story. I know that I just went into that for a while, but there's a whole story behind this bear.
Yeah, I love that you tuned into Moritz. Moritz is actually, his starting bid is at $100, but Moritz is worth, I think, more than $400. These teddy bears were very, very expensive when they were sold in their time, and he's kind of a leftover. He's, from an artist who's no longer around. So I knew Steve Shutt personally, and he was a huge celebrity in the teddy bear world. And Moritz is not a toy. He's a collector's item. But he's really, if you look in the auction, he's really cute because he's sitting there and he's looking completely outraged at the fact that he's in an auction. He has a look on his face like, what the heck is going on?
Well, I think he's wondering, is that all I'm worth?
I think so too.
There's also there's a piece basket too I like. It's got a, I don't know, I'm reading it right now. It says it's a fair trade basket. The basket's cool. It has it's cloth basket from Baghdad. These are the two things that I'm looking at bidding on. There's some dark chocolate, which I love, some coffee, peace coffee, Thai curry cashews. Sounds good to me. And then there's dark chocolate with orange. My favorite type of chocolate is orange chocolate. And then there's divine dark chocolate with toffee and sea salt. Also one of my favorites. And a Nepali bag with mini chocolate bars. That's my other favorite.
That's pretty nice.
So I'm
kind
of going back and forth between the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And then there's a Wild Root in Nevada is an organic hair salon, and they're offering a facial, which is, really a wonderful offer, that which is also worth quite a bit more than it's going for on the auction. So the auction is not only a place to get really kind of unique things, it's also a really inexpensive place to get items. Stephanie, we're going to have to end in a minute, tell me one more of your favorite items in the auction.
Well, I think people are bidding on one that I like in particular, but I do like, let me look at it right here. That's what I've been checking on. Gosh, the bear that's my favorite.
You like the bear.
But I love the bear. I don't think, but I have a few other pieces that I would say you could purchase. That would be great. But I think really people should look at that purple glass pendant.
Okay. And Stephanie, real fast, what is the name of your business and where can it be found online?
Thank you for asking, Ursula. It's Silo House, S-I-L-O House. And it can be found at www.silohouse.com.
Say that again.
It's silohouse.com. That's where you can find it. Or you can, I have a Facebook page too for it. It's okay. Silo House.
So you make and sell mostly jewelry, right?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. And tie-dyes, but like those types, and candles. But I would say jewelry is the main thing that we actually sell.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Our show's coming to an end. The place to go to the auction is khoyfm.org. Go to the blue auction button. And this has been Local Talk. I've been your host, Ursula Rudenberg. I'm here with Stephanie Bates, jeweler from Silo House. And and this is KHOI, Story City Ames. And now we'll go to Democracy Now.
This is Democracy Now.
It's incredibly important that, you know, people in India get it, people in Kenya get it, people in the United States get it. People